Fire Engineering Podcasts are sponsored by MSA. Firefighters want to be connected to each other, to dispatch, and to their commanders. MSA has created Lunar, a wireless, handheld device that includes thermal imaging, firefighter ranging, motion alarm, and cloud technology with GPS. It's part of the new connected firefighter platform from MSA. Learn more at msafire.com.
Good evening. On tonight's episode of Fire Engineering Blog Radio, Women in Fire is joined by Kurt Verone to discuss the recent white paper that he produced with Lexipol, Understanding, Preventing, and Responding to Sexual Harassment in the Fire Service. We are very honored to have Kurt join us for the next hour and look forward to discussing this paper and some of his background. Kurt, welcome. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
So my background, I've been in the fire service now. I stopped counting after 40 years, and I've been a practicing attorney now for over 30 years. Stopped counting after 30. There's no need, you know. My fire service experience sort of spans career combination and volunteer. I spent most of my, I would say like really the center of my career was with the Providence Fire Department, and went through the ranks, retired as a deputy assistant chief, which is a shift commander, and started in the volunteer service, progressed through the combination department that was close by Providence, and got on Providence, and I'm now with the Exeter Fire Department. So still, you know, involved in the fire service, still have some of the same challenges that everybody's facing, just on a different, you know, certainly a different scale. My law practice is concentrated on legal issues in the fire service, and other than some neighbors and, you know, family, friends, virtually everything that I do is, you know, in the law world is fire service related. And my clients are, many of them are firefighter unions, but also I represent fire chiefs, fire departments, fire districts, and individual firefighters as well. So, I do a lot of seminars, write for Firehouse. I have a book that was published by Fire Engineering, so kind of have one foot in each camp there.
Yeah, we actually used your book, the Legal Considerations book, in a class that I took, and also referenced the blog that you have fairly regularly. So I definitely appreciated the work that you've done, and definitely lends a lot of value, I believe, to the fire service.
Yeah, I try, and you know, every day I get up and I'm trying to stay current on what's leading to the problems that the fire service is facing when it comes to litigation. And I have a database, closing in on 10,000 cases now in the database. And the building of that database, which has taken up, I spend 2-3, sometimes more hours a day, every day, 7 days a week, adding cases to that database. And so a lot of my thinking, a lot of my writing, certainly my lecturing, and then the advice and counsel that I give people is a product of the time I invest in understanding what's leading to lawsuits and what are we going to do to prevent them.
Yeah, it's definitely very valuable and much needed. We're very happy to have you, and it's unfortunate that we have to have that, but hence we do. So we do have the white paper that we'd like to talk about, and you worked with Lexipol to produce this essentially, and we're just going to kind of dive through some of the content that was created for the white paper itself, and maybe you can give us a little bit of background on the formation of the paper itself, and then we'll dive into the content.
Lexipol had approached me on a number of different projects that they're interested in, because they're deeply committed to trying to, number one, understand what is our biggest liability and what are the areas that fire departments have to be concerned with, and then how do we sort of wrestle with whatever the thing that's leading to the liability is. So, and they understand that I have sort of my finger on the pulse of what's going on. And so they they had originally asked me, you know, what's our biggest liability? What's leading to liabilities? And, you know, sexual harassment and sexual discrimination, gender discrimination lawsuits are the top liability area. According to my data, and this last time I ran it, closely behind that, just a, you know, fractions, you know, maybe 3 or 4 percentage points behind that is race discrimination. But, you know, I think the biggest liability right now that fire departments are facing, according to my data, is a sexual harassment lawsuit or some sort of a gender-related type of lawsuit. Now, the policy implications for that and some of the other things led them to ask me to maybe come up with, you know, a brief outline of what can fire departments do to prevent that. And I kind of push back, and I love the folks at Lexapol, you know, I think they have a better appreciation for me after I did this, but I kind of push back, and I said, look, this is not something that we're going to come up with, do these 5 things, and you're going to solve your sexual harassment problem. This is not that kind of a problem, and I don't want to be associated with any sort of, you know, fancy just do these 2 things, or just do this, or just do that, and you're going to fix this problem. This is an enormous problem, and it's not going to be fixed overnight, and I don't want to be part of even suggesting that it can be fixed by just doing these cutesy little techniques.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they kind of were taken aback because they were thinking maybe we do like a little 2 or 3 page summary, and so as we started going through the project, they realized, holy cow, this is closing in on 20 pages. And, you know, is there things we can cut out and, you know, can we not address this and address that? And, you know, they really took my advice and my perspective to heart. And I said, no, because it won't do justice to the problem. That if we're going to address this in a serious way, in more than a superficial way, we've got to do it in this sort of manner to address all the different aspects of it. And, you know, I really appreciate the fact that they trusted my judgment in that, and the white paper was the end product of it.
This is Angie. We really appreciate everything you do for us and how quick you are to respond and help us. And we know the value of your training. Oops. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about is you talk about it just can't simply be solved as a zero tolerance stance. When you think of training.
I didn't say that. I didn't say that. But, you know, zero tolerance. And first of all, I don't even know what zero tolerance is. So that's one of those cutesy little phrases that, you know, people like to throw out there as if there's a simple solution to a complex problem. But, you know, I can tell you right now, there is no simple solution to this. There is no way to get a club and start hitting the cavemen over the head with it and get them to stop acting like that. The problem is much deeper and it goes a lot further than that.
Sure. And I guess what I mean is in your white paper, you say that most of the leaders think that's the way to solve the problems of harassment in the fire service, just taking a zero tolerance stance. So what tools can we empower ourselves with? What kind of training, what things would you recommend to help educate and prevent members of the fire department with sexual harassment?
Well, we've got to recognize the problem for what it is, and it's a hearts and minds problem. And I know, Andrew, you and I have talked about this, but it's not what at the National Fire Academy and the Executive Fire Officer Program we refer to as a technical problem. Technical problem is one of those that we have a known answer to the problem. I'm going back to the writings of Marty Linsky and Ron Heifetz. That's used in the National Fire Academy. And I mentioned that briefly in the white paper, but the reality of a technical problem is, and I think the best metaphor was used in the book, is like someone who has appendicitis. And we know what the solution to someone who has appendicitis is. They're going to need surgery. Now, that doesn't mean that anyone can solve the problem. It just means that appendicitis is a known problem, and we have a known solution. There's skills that are required to address a known problem. You know, you need an MD, and in particular, you're going to need a surgeon, and you need a facility that is capable of safely doing the surgery and all the other things that go along with it. So it doesn't, because something's a technical problem, doesn't necessarily mean it's easy. It just means that there's a known solution. The counterbalance to a technical problem is an adaptive challenge. And an adaptive challenge is where we've tried known solutions. We've tried them, we try them again, we try them again, we try them again. No matter what we do, everyone fails. And we are still left with the problem. And that's a strong indication that what we're dealing with is an adaptive challenge. An adaptive challenge, when you look at all of the adaptive challenges that have been identified in society, in many different cultures, at the core of an adaptive challenge is a hearts and minds problem, that people are vested in the status quo. And they're content with the status quo. Maybe they feel that the status quo is being forced upon them and they're making the best of it. Whatever their rationalization is, they're vested in the status quo and they're not willing to change. And no amount of technical solution is going to change that. And the example they use in the book is a really good one, and I hope it doesn't offend anybody, but it's the Vietnam War. And when we get into the Vietnam War, Vietnam had already been through the French involvement in Vietnam. And when we got involved in it, we started trying to do the same thing that the French had tried to do. And the same thing that had worked for us in the First World War, it worked for us in the Second World War, worked to a lesser degree, but still worked pretty much in Korea, which was put a bunch of our best on ships and airplanes and send them out there in harm's way with guns and all the other instruments of war and kick butt. And it didn't work. And we kept trying it and trying it and trying it, and it just didn't work. It's because it's about hearts and minds. And so, you know, and I think kind of bringing that back to our discussion here today, it's a lot. Sexual harassment in the fire service is a lot like the Vietnam War, where we keep applying those technical solutions. And by the way, I never meant to suggest that we shouldn't keep using those technical solutions. And the technical solutions are disciplining the firefighters, civil suits brought by people who are the victims of sexual harassment. We have to continue those technical solutions. But we have to realize there's a limitation to them. They will deal with a specific situation in a given instance, but they're not going to solve the problem because it's a hearts and minds problem.
Right.
And when you're dealing with an adaptive challenge, the solution is transformational leadership, leadership that's capable of changing people's hearts and minds. And again, you know, we could spend all day and all week talking about transformational leadership and adaptive challenges and creating productive disequilibrium. But I think that folks who are seriously interested in solving this problem, they need to study the book that was written by Heifetz and Linsky called Leadership on the Line. Understand the lessons there and then incorporate that kind of transformational leadership into their normal daily functions as leaders. That is and it's not going to be easy. It's no magic wand about how to bring that kind of transformational leadership into a fire service organization.
Right. Now, that certainly is a long game type of an accomplishment.
Right. And you know, and in the meantime, we still have to continue to use HR. We still have to continue to use discipline. We still have to continue to apply all of those technical solutions. It's not that we can back off of those. But to me, what we need to be willing to do and what leaders need to be willing to do is look for opportunities to exercise transformational leadership. And that means, you know, looking for opportunities to increase disequilibrium. And, you know, disequilibrium is, you know, challenging some of the things that maybe people assume are the ways that it has to be. And making people feel uncomfortable. Okay? Give you an example. Another example, whenever I talk about disequilibrium, I go back to September 10th of 2001. And would what is happening today in airports in terms of security lines, would that have been tolerated on September 10th?
Not likely.
Okay, and people would have been outraged. There's no way we're going to tolerate this. This is crazy. Whoever came up with this idea, they're nuts, okay, and we're not going to tolerate it. We had disequilibrium hit us. It was a gut punch on September 11th. And that disequilibrium that we all felt on September 11th opened our hearts and minds to the reality that, you know, things can't be the same. We have to change. I certainly don't recommend that kind of disequilibrium because that, you know,
right.
that's horrendous. But that's an example of how the status quo can be changed by disequilibrium. And I think effective leaders find a way not to in that tragic way,
right.
But find different ways to increase the disequilibrium you know, try to get some movement on some of these very, very difficult issues.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a very valid point, is that it definitely has to be bought into by the leaders. One thing that I appreciate about the information that's gathered is that you kind of get into the basics early on of just defining what sexual harassment is and kind of the difference between harassment and assault. Can we talk through that a little bit, just in case we have some listeners that are a bit newer to the topic or to the fire service in general?
Sure. In terms of a basic definition of sexual harassment?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, different states have different definitions of sexual harassment. It's not something that there's a single definition that's universal. The federal EEOC has a definition, they don't say it's a definition, because essentially what we're talking about with sexual harassment is it's a form of gender discrimination. And federal law, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, prohibits gender discrimination. Sexual harassment is a form of gender discrimination, and I can read you right from the white paper, basically what the EEOC said. Sexual harassment involves harassing an applicant or an employee because of that person's sex. It may include unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, or other verbal or physical harassment of a sexual nature. Okay? However, the harassment doesn't have to be of a sexual nature. It is illegal to harass someone because of their gender. Okay, so I guess, you know, you could have sexual harassment that is harassment that is sexual in nature. Okay, mm-hmm. Could be videos, magazines, jokes that are sexual in nature. That can, you know, constitute sexual harassment if it is severe or pervasive. But harassment of a woman because she is a woman that has nothing to do with gender, but it has to do with the fact that she's a woman, is sexual harassment. So there's really kind of two aspects of that. There's also two different types of sexual harassment, quid pro quo, and which is Latin for this, for that, which is basically a proposition. You know, if you sleep with me, you'll get a promotion, or if you go out on a date with me, you'll get extra overtime. that type of nature, or hostile work environment, sexual harassment. My data is somewhere around 90% of, a little over 90% of the cases that are filed in the fire service are the hostile work environment type. It's actually pretty rare to see the quid pro quo. It's not that it doesn't happen, it does happen, but it's actually pretty rare. And in almost all of the cases of quid pro quo, we also see hostile work environment harassment.
Mm. Okay. Very often does assault come up within what you've seen as far as your data?
It does. But I wouldn't say off the top of my head, I couldn't give you a percentage of the cases. It does come up. But I think, you know, there's a lot of things that happen in the firehouse, that could technically be an assault, you know, and, the family nature of firehouse life, you know, like somebody's like telling a joke and pushes somebody, or, you know, you get a whipped cream pie in the face, or those types of things. You know, technically those could be assaults.
Right.
What we're talking about here with sexual harassment, those, you know, if a female is subjected to that kind of harassment on account of her gender, that could be sexual harassment as well. But, you know, could it be an assault? It could be. But I think really the bigger concern here is sexual-based assault, like, you know, where there's some sort of sexual motive in the assault. And, you know, we do see it, you know, but it's you know, I would think off the top of my head, I'd guess it's probably less than 20% of the cases.
Okay. Kurt, can you talk a little bit just about when you talk about sexual harassment versus sexually harassing behavior and the difference about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, unfortunately, many fire departments sort of are reacting to women in the workplace. And you know, I was in a fire department recently, good, pretty good sized career department that had no women in it. And I was really kind of taken aback by that. And, but at some point that department, is going to have to sort of, come to the realization that they're going to need a sexual harassment policy. Maybe up to this point they haven't, maybe they reluctantly adopted one because the city HR is making them, or maybe they have a paper policy or whatever. But all too often, I think fire departments have not really, they might say they've embraced women in the fire service, but they haven't really embraced, you know, the presence of women. They haven't prepared the stations. They haven't spent the money that should have been spent to prepare the workplace. And one of the things that often gets overlooked is the sexual harassment policy. And so they will simply adopt a sexual harassment policy. Maybe it's one that the city had, maybe it's one that a neighboring fire department had, or whatever. But essentially, it prohibits sexual harassment. And the legal definition of sexual harassment in most jurisdictions requires that the harassment be severe or pervasive. Okay, so pervasive means, you know, there's an awful lot of people doing it and it's every day or on a regular basis, but it's happening an awful lot. Mm-hmm. Severe could be a single incident, I guess, if there was some sort of a sexual assault, but usually it's got to be something more than just a joke here or there. It has to be, you know, severe or pervasive. So the fire department that has simply adopted a policy, they're just doing check the box things. Oh, we're hiring women now, we got to have a sexual harassment policy and all that. They haven't really thought that part of it through. They prohibit sexual harassment. And then now eventually it's going to happen. A male firefighter now has committed sexual harassment, or is accused of committing sexual harassment, done something inappropriate, but it's not severe or it's not pervasive. And now the department wants to discipline the firefighter, and they're saying, well, we're going to charge him with committing sexual harassment. And the attorney that's defending the firefighter, or the union that's defending the firefighter, is going to say, well, wait a minute, this wasn't severe, and it wasn't pervasive, so therefore he's not guilty of committing sexual harassment. And they haven't really, again, they haven't really taken the time to think through this whole issue and realize, wait a minute, you know, what we really want to prevent here, what we really want to prohibit, is sexually harassing behavior. And sexually harassing behavior, if you do it once, you could be disciplined. You know, and second, third, fourth offenses, now those are each additional charges. So, again, I think that fire departments have to have policies that prohibit not just sexual harassment, but sexually harassing behavior. And the behavior, you know, could be the telling of an off-color joke. It could be using some of the common locker room type of language that I think is very common in many firehouses where there are no women, and, you know, occasionally even when there are women, and occasionally some of the conversations include women that are using the, you know, the kind of the street vernacular that's common in locker rooms.
Sure. Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, it's not, of course, we're a women's organization as we address this with you, but it's not just a problem that women face, too.
No, it's not. And again, that's one of the things that makes it so difficult to deal with. Because we're talking about changing hearts and minds, you know, changing the status quo from things that have always been tolerated, conversations, jokes, and different things, and changing that to where it's not going to be tolerated. And, you know, there's people that push back. They don't want to see that change, that they're vested in that way, just like people were on September 10th. They didn't want to see those long lines and have to be searched and all that. You know, they weren't willing to go there willingly.
Yeah, absolutely. What is your thoughts on the Me Too movement? And do you feel like that's been good for us as a fire service in understanding this problem?
You know, it's hard for me to say, because I think that the claims, there's been no shortage of claims prior to the Me Too movement. So I don't really see it as helping or hurting. You know, we have our issues, and my experience, I've represented dozens of women who have been harassed over the years, and each one is different. Each one is a unique personality. The circumstances are different. The departments, often, like I have had a couple in the same departments, but each of them is in a different place in their life and struggling with different aspects of it. And the solution to each of them is different as well. But one common thread throughout them is they really do not want to report it. Mm-hmm. And they sort of come to me, not as a last resort, but they're just, you know, I'll get a call. Hey, Chief, can I meet you for a coffee? I got to talk to you about something. Or can I have an hour of your time? I really need to get something off my chest. And that's how it starts. And inevitably, they don't want to report it. They know that once they report it, their life will never be the same.
Right.
And they don't want to hurt somebody either, but it's got to stop. It's affecting them. It's affecting their ability. It's they're sick to their stomach at the thought of going to work.
Yeah, and I think
and it shouldn't be like that.
Right. No, I think that actually it's kind of a good lead into the next topic I was going to ask you about, was the kind of the concerns that do surround reporting and what that looks like if someone is in a situation where they find themselves feeling the victim, or even maybe concerned about some behavior that they've seen, and the back and forth of the decision to report and what that looks like.
Again, I think I'm in a unique position, because people come to me in confidence, and they know that they can come to me in confidence. And that was, I think, one of the challenges I had when I was still on the fire department in Providence, because people would come to me and I'd have to tell them, look, I'm an attorney, yes, but I'm also your boss. And, you know, I have to have that conversation and say, if you tell me something, I can't pretend that you didn't tell me that.
Exactly.
So, you know, I hate to be that kind of person who's not going to be open to you and willing to talk to you. You got to understand, if you tell me something happened, I can't pretend I'm not aware of it. And that's a problem. So it's easier now that I'm retired. I can have conversations with people that, other than in my own department, but I can have those kind of conversations and honor their request not to move forward on it. But, you know, I think that, and again, this not that there's an excess of firefighter attorneys out there that are in that same position, but when you are an attorney, it certainly, and you're in the same organization, it puts you in a hard spot. But I think that there's a lack of people that women in that situation can go to. They can go to attorneys, but attorneys have no idea about what it's like in the firehouse. And they can talk to maybe other firefighters, but they have no idea what the legal prospects look like. You know? So it's very difficult. And I feel like I'm in a good spot now where I can kind of give people better advice. But many fire departments are not doing a good job of handling the formal complaint once it comes in. And there's a lot of reasons for it. I kind of outline some of the things that I have personally experienced, I have personally witnessed that are barriers to the proper handling of those complaints. And I put those in the white paper. And you know, it's difficult. It's difficult. Many departments are not doing good investigations on it.
So as a department that maybe decides to evaluate their process or how they are handling reports and complaints, what should be some of the base pieces that should be in place?
Well, and I mentioned this, I'm not sure I made it clear in the white paper, but you cannot create credibility during an investigation. You have to do an investigation, and people have to look at how the investigation was done, and then you have credibility going forward. So you have to develop a track record of taking the complaint seriously, properly investigating it, and not allowing yourself, you know, from the department's perspective, to sort of prejudge how the investigation should come out. And I think many departments are guilty of that, almost on a subliminal or subconscious basis, that they have a male firefighter who maybe is a fire academy instructor and on the technical rescue team and is loved by everyone who knows him, and you have a female that's maybe not. And they almost make a subconscious decision that we don't want to see this go forward, you know, and that sends a message to everybody, which then makes it harder for the next person. And you know, it's difficult, and I don't want to, you know, go too far into that because I'm going to end up coming close to disclosing client confidences.
Okay.
I don't want to do that. But
no.
I've seen this same pattern too many times for me not to realize that it's playing a role in the decision making, and I think many well-intentioned chiefs are not recognizing that this is happening. They're looking at the personalities, they're looking at the value of the people to the organization, and they're not doing a thorough job of investigating. And then that sets the stage for the next case. The next case might be in 6 months, it might be in a couple of years, but it sends a chilling message if they don't do a good investigation and it's biased in favor of the male firefighter. It sends a very chilling message to the next female who feels she's being harassed.
Mm-hmm.
It may embolden some of the Neanderthals that
right.
may feel that it's okay to engage in this kind of behavior.
I mean, truly a lack of accountability does set a tone throughout the organization.
It does, and the converse is true too. Where you know, when we do a full and fair investigation, and you know, I get it that you don't want to, you know, somebody who's got done a has a stellar career, and you don't want to hurt their job. Well, don't short circuit the investigation by not doing the investigation. Don't right. short circuit it by doing a, you know, show your compassion at the back end. Get the behavior to stop. Do the investigation so everybody sees, well, you know what? You know, they did a full and fair investigation. The charges were sustained. So maybe they went a little easy on this guy because of his value to the organization. Okay. But don't short circuit it when the complaint comes in. Don't drag your feet through the investigation and don't short circuit the outcome of the investigation. Let the chips fall where they may. And then that sets you up for the next investigation that you've got credibility.
So I know some organizations will bring in a third party investigator, if you will, or someone who's not necessarily tied to the organization. Do you think there's value in that?
Yeah, I hate that. I absolutely hate that. And I understand that it's necessary sometimes. But there's an awful lot of people, and one of the things I teach a 2-day class on discipline, and one of the metaphors that I use in the class is the dog chasing the rabbit. Every one of us has a prey drive in us, and it shows itself in a lot of different ways. But one of the ways it shows itself in law enforcement as well as during discipline investigations is when an investigator reaches the conclusion that someone has done something wrong and twists neutral appearing facts to fit their theory of the case. And they become like the dog chasing the rabbit, with the accused being the rabbit. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very easy when someone is outside the organization, particularly if they're not skilled, and they don't recognize that in themselves, that they're becoming like the dog chasing the rabbit. And I emphasize to my investigators that you've got to do a full and fair investigation. It's better to let 100 guilty people go free than to let one innocent person be convicted. And that's something my mom taught me as a young boy. So, you know, and we're going to do a diligent investigation, but it's not going to be a dog chasing a rabbit type of investigation. It has to be a fair investigation. And my concern often when an attorney or someone outside the organization comes in, they're not doing a full and fair investigation. Now, that's not to say every firefighter is going to do a full and fair investigation, every battalion chief or deputy chief or whoever the investigator may be. Mm-hmm. But I think if they're trained to do the investigation, then they should, you know, then they hopefully will do a full and fair investigation. But sure. Again, to have credibility going forward, you've got to do a fair investigation. It can't be a whitewash, and it can't be a witch hunt.
Okay.
Kurt, when you talk about the fair investigations, that's one thing I've always struggled with and wondered what is the right thing to do. If you have two people in the same station, let's say it's a supervisor is accused of harassing a firefighter, do you separate them or don't you separate them? What's the best policy for that?
Well, the safest policy is to leave them both where they are, assuming that we can manage the dispute, the interpersonal dispute. Now, if that's not possible, you cannot move the victim or the person who's claiming to be the victim. You can't do that. If you do that against their will, you might as well just write them a check because you've committed retaliation. You just can't do that. Unfortunately, then that leaves the accused, and the accused is simply an accused. They're not guilty of anything, but you can't move the victim. You have to move the accused. That's why you want to try to keep them in place and put some things in place, but especially where you're dealing with a supervisor, you know, it'd be very, very difficult. We have a supervisor accused of sexually harassing a subordinate. It'd be very difficult to keep that, you know, that combination together and expect not to have more problems. And, you know, we talk about two types of biases that really are playing, a huge role in what we're dealing with. Implicit bias is one aspect where this is like a subconscious bias that people have. And it's different than conscious bias. Like, I'm a New England Patriots fan, and, you know, I can hear the
blues. I won't hold that against you.
I can hear the blues. but I know that, and I can sort of, you know, make sure that, you know, when I go to Seattle or Atlanta, you know, that I really am careful about what I say so I don't offend anybody because of what ended up happening to both of those teams. So, mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there's a subconscious bias. Implicit bias is subconscious where you don't even realize it. And when someone files a complaint against you, you're going to have that bias against them. That officer now is going to be prone to see things in the subordinate that maybe they didn't notice before, but it's going to be a problem. To keep them together is going to be a problem. So, you know, if they're both peers and you have a strong officer, I think it's easier. When the officer is the one and you throw in implicit bias, you've got a problem. The other side of it is a thing called confirmation bias. And confirmation bias is when you have a certain narrative in your mind, you're more prone to see people's neutral appearing actions as validating your predetermined beliefs. So let's use a stereotypical female who's accusing a stereotypical male of sexual harassment. But confirmation bias, the male could say hello in the morning, and she could be offended by that because she's already got in his mind, he's already harassed me, what did he mean by hello? And, you know, that's confirmation bias. And you have both of those. You have implicit bias and confirmation bias at work between these two people who already have a problem. And, you know, it's risky. It's risky to keep them together. But, you know, if you move the victim, it's going to be retaliation. You can't do that. The only other one that can move is the accused. And that may not be fair, but, you know, it is what it is. And that's not going to stop other people from their implicit bias and confirmation bias ramping up their scrutiny of the person who made the accusations. And that's another problem that we see on a regular basis, that once somebody makes the allegations, everyone turns against the person because they've attacked our culture. So, I started out by saying, you know, we have an adaptive challenge here. There is no simple solution to it, but we've got to kind of work through all these issues.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough one, for sure.
So, I mean, I guess you've kind of touched on quite a bit the importance of culture and the approach from the department's perspective. What are some preventative measures that an organization could put in place before they even encounter this as being, a situation they find themselves in?
Well, having a policy, you've got to have a sexual harassment policy. That's not transformational leadership. That's a technical solution. You need to have a policy. You also need to have training. And when I say training, I'm not talking about check the box training. I think, again, many fire departments sort of reluctantly began hiring women and didn't do the proper groundwork. They didn't prepare the stations. And the training, yeah, they did check the box training. But it was obvious to everybody in the department that it was just check the box training.
Sure.
And, I mean, I guess check-the-box training is better than no training, but there's again, transformational ways that the leadership can send a message to the personnel that this is important. I'm the fire chief. This is important. And I think leaders need to make that effort to make those training exercises more than just the check-the-box exercise. In addition, officers need to be trained separately from the firefighters. When you put officers, when you put captains and lieutenants in the same room as firefighters and give them the same training, you're saying, whether you mean it or not, you're saying you're both the same.
Okay.
And officers are not the same when it comes to this. That officers have to understand they have a heightened responsibility to address this. And so it's fine to put, if you want to give them the general training, give them the general training together, but officers have to be trained separately. They have to understand their obligation is to stop this and not wait for a complaint, but they need to stop it.
Yeah.
And something can't be okay one day. Certain conversations in the firehouse cannot be okay one day and not okay the next day.
Right.
So if something is offensive on a Monday when a certain firefighter is there, they're just as offensive if that person is not there the following day. And again, officers need to understand this, and that there's a ton of cases. I post as much information as I possibly can on my blog to provide resources. There's tons of cases. People can read the decisions. They can read the complaints, read the allegations themselves, and kind of say, wow, that sounds an awful lot like what's going on in my fire department.
Right.
And utilize those to help get the message out there. But officers have to be trained separately, and officers also have to understand that when if you're a captain and you're aware that someone is being sexually harassed, it's as if the fire chief is aware of it. You can't sit on that information, that it's the same as the fire chief being aware of it. The department is aware of it, and you know, you need to act appropriately.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, so obviously training needs to be provided on a continual basis. Do you have any thoughts on how frequent that should be, or you know, different styles of training, or?
Well, the frequency of it, most states, most municipalities want to see it annually. And I don't have a problem with annual training. But again, if it becomes a check-the-box exercise, it's useless. You know,
right.
It's fine. You're going to have a defense if you get sued. You know, which to me, everybody's lawsuit. But to me, let's prevent the circumstances from happening through the training. That should be the focus of the training. Let's prevent this from happening. Not let's give ourselves a defense if we're sued. Let's prevent it from happening, and that needs to be the focus of the training. And that kind of changes the perspective of the training. Is the training just so that it's a check-the-box exercise, so if we get sued, we can say, oh, well, we gave them annual training? Or is it really about, you know, how do we prevent this from happening? How do we increase people's understanding of the issues? You know, and then that gives you maybe some different perspective on the content of the training. Because if it's just a check-the-box exercise, who cares? We can go on Target Solutions or some other platform and go take a sexual harassment
class.
Right,
very true.
But when the real goal is not just to give yourself a defense, it's really to prevent it from happening, maybe there's some other things that maybe we could do. Maybe some role play, maybe some other types of things, particularly with officers. And I think that's what we don't do a good enough job preparing our officers for the HR aspects of their job.
Yeah.
We put a great deal into them being proficient operationally, but when it comes to HR, we just assume that they know what to do, and they prove it time and time again they don't.
So that's a good question, and of course I'll give you a plug, but who is the best person to provide that training? Should it be in department? Should it be an HR person that doesn't really understand our culture? Who do we need to have that training or train the officers?
It's a problem, and I'm doing my best to try to fill it, but I'm just one person. But the ongoing, I don't want to insult people, but nonsensical, useless training that we get from many HR professionals, and you know that just it works if you're in cubicle world, if you're you know, you're in cubicle world, it's maybe a good class. It's not going to work with firefighters. You know, they're just, they're going to, you know, they're going to go wherever they go when they're in a class and they're bored out of their minds, and it's not going to really make a difference. So we have to find a way to get realistic training, wherever it comes from. If it comes from me, I do some of the training, but I can only do so much. I've got a couple of other firefighter attorneys that are working with me to try to deliver some of it. But again, you know, not every department can afford to do that. So we've got to develop some courses. And, you know, one of the problems with a lot of the canned courses, you know, is that it was, you know, a committee came up with it with good ideas. But again, it's almost like check the box kind of stuff and not realistic types. And you know, I give you a metaphor that I use in my classes is I have a picture of an engine company arriving first on the scene, and the picture is taken like from the jump seat area and looking through the windshield at a house that's on fire, and it shows the officer's position and the driver's position, and you think about the skills that we expect out of that officer riding in that officer's seat, and the ability to, you know, operate the radio, make a good size up, call for what resources, make a good tactical decision, and so on. We expect a lot out of that officer, and we've prepared that person for that. But when we haven't prepared that person for dealing with somebody using an inappropriate word or telling an inappropriate joke in the firehouse, or maybe picking on somebody, not necessarily a female, it could be anybody in a protected class, but picking on the weakling in the firehouse, and the officer just sits back and lets it happen, we can say, oh, that officer should have done something. But has that officer been trained? You know, if we allow somebody to be a captain and they've never been to a fire, they've never been to the fire academy, they've never watched a video, never read a book on how to fight a fire, I know that's ridiculous, but how successful are they going to be when they're in the front seat of that truck and they're first in a house fire?
Yeah, not very.
And whose fault is it? Is it the person's fault or is it the department's fault? It's the department's fault. They let that person be there. What happens when we let a captain be the captain in a company and the captain doesn't know how to handle, let's say, a firefighter using the N-word in the firehouse? Never been trained, never did a role play, never thought about what all of the options that he or she has to deal with that. And the same thing with sexual harassment, inappropriate jokes, and right on down the line. So the department needs to really think about that. And then to kind of come back to where I started, that's the kind of training that we need to be focused on. That it's just like we don't just let somebody read an IFSTA manual and say, okay, you're a captain now. There's a lot of experience. We use incident command simulators today and a lot of other things. We let them watch videos about other people, how other people have screwed things up or how firefighters have gotten killed and what not to do. We don't apply the same training methodology when it comes to HR. And I think that's what's missing. And whether that's taught by me, whether it's taught by an experienced battalion chief or an HR person, it needs to be real.
Right. No, I mean, it certainly sounds like there's more work to be done in that area. And you bring up some very solid points about the fact that, you know, putting people in the role without having them properly trained is irresponsible, probably happens more than it should. And in all reality, personnel issues come up much more frequently these days than fires do. So one other thing I wanted to touch on as far as a topic that was within the white paper itself that I thought was kind of interesting was the Explorer program and considerations that departments should take into place when they do have junior members or minors, I suppose, within their organizations.
Yeah, it's it's a problem. And it's a problem to the point where I've advised many of my clients don't have junior firefighters, don't have Explorer programs. Or, you know, if you're going to, you need to take the following steps. And those steps are pretty much outlined in the white paper. But many fire departments are not willing to do that, and they're rolling the dice. If you're not willing to take the steps to protect those individuals, those kids who want to be firefighters someday, you're really rolling the dice. So it's one of those things. If you're going to do it, if you're going to have a junior program, and you're going to have explorers or whatever the particulars of it are, you've got to do it right. And if you don't, there's big consequences.
Okay. Good. Well, Kurt, I certainly appreciate you joining us today. This has been a good hour. Of course, thank you to Lexapol as well for backing this project. What a great resource. And I know you put so much effort into this. And thank you for taking an hour out of your day to join us and talk through a topic that we definitely talk about quite a bit within our organization.
Well, yeah, my pleasure.
Kurt, one more thing, this is Angie. You'll be at FDIC teaching about these very subjects?
Yeah, I am at FDIC. Off the top of my head, I don't recall what I'm speaking on, but I will be at FDIC and some of the other conferences as well.
Yeah. Great. Well, we always enjoy seeing you there. Again, as Amy said, we really appreciate everything you do for the fire service and for our organization.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And that is it for this episode. Have a good evening. Mm-hmm.